Hi, listeners. You can now listen to this community podcast production ad-free on Apple Podcasts and access the podcast 1 week early and get exclusive bonus content. Just hit the subscribe button now on Apple Podcasts. Or if you want access to all of the above, plus video versions of the podcast, head to patreon.com/stopthekilling.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
I'm Sarah Ferris, true crime podcaster.
And I'm Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
And you're listening to Stop the Killing. Welcome to another episode of Stop the Killing. Catherine, today we're talking about the case that we've done a lot of episodes on, the Oxford School shooting. Why are we revisiting this again? Tell me everything.
The Oxford High School shooting, if you were living on Mars and you don't know, there were four high school students who were killed in the hallway at the high school outside of Detroit, Michigan suburbs, by a classmate who pled guilty to the murders and terrorism, was sentenced to jail. He will not ever get out. And then his parents are now charged with involuntary manslaughter. His mother has been found guilty. His father is also found guilty. So the reason that I wanted to have this conversation today is there was a very initial thorough report put together about so many different things. And part of the report had maybe 50 pages or so on the shooter and what we knew about the shooter through his school years. And we very rarely get an opportunity to get this many details about how somebody turned into a shooter as a 15-year-old, especially from school records, right? And this was in part put together, as they say, because there was a question that was put forward about whether or not the school district should have done something or could have done something, for instance, a threat assessment on him. And if so, when did they see it coming? And so I think very thoughtfully, they did a pretty thorough examination of what they had available to look back all the way to when he actually started in the school, which I believe was in fourth grade. So about a 9-year-old. So way back, the shooting occurs when he's 15, but they have records that go back to fourth grade and they piece them together. And I think I would say at the outset, the caution is every investigation is this way. It's always easy to look back and see all the pieces of the puzzle and say, they should have, someone should have, you know, it was very obvious. That doesn't mean that when you're in that spot and you have that piece of the puzzle, you can see the other pieces. So there's an optics situation in every case. So I want to have a little conversation about that. I wanted to mention some of the Patreon before we launch into something, because I think that I forget sometimes about how there are people out there supporting us because they can. And even if it's, you know, $5 a month, $10 a month, that makes such a difference to us, or pounds, as you would say. It makes such a difference to us being able to try to continue to do this with our time and the equipment and the effort that's used. So
yeah,
I know I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, but can you do some shout outs for me on maybe some of our...
I can. And you know what's interesting is I realized the other day when I was looking at the Patreon account that we've actually got a lot of members that have joined free. They just want to be part of the community as well, which, I mean, I completely get. I get that people can't always be financially supporting the podcast, but we love that you have come over to the Patreon page.
I love that. I love that. And maybe explain what the Patreon page is.
And sure.
It's in our show notes, but Patreon, mm-hmm. right?
Yep. Patreon.com/ stop the killing. And that'll take you to the page, or you obviously you can look in the show notes.
But on Patreon itself is a mechanism to allow people to get additional material, but also to support. And there are plenty of organizations and efforts on Patreon. It's a way that you can provide small scale support. So, but Patreon, it's a way that allows people to be part of something they think is important.
Yeah, it really does fuel the podcast for us as well. Having that support monthly is great to be able to rely on. And, you know, I thought it was interesting that there was so many people that had come over and joined free, because I haven't been putting a lot of free content on there. But knowing that there's that interest, I will make sure that I start putting some specifically free stuff on there. So if you want to come and be part of that community, go over to the Patreon page and check it out and become a member, free or not. If you can support us, amazing. If not, we want you to be able to have access to a community that really cares about what we're doing. And we love that. I just wanted to give a shout out to even a couple of the members that are free members and have taken the time to come over and support the podcast there.
I love that.
Kirsty L is our first one. Melanie Molina and Jim Cipollini. So thank you to our fabulous supporters. And, you know, not just on Patreon, we also have people that subscribe on Apple Podcasts as well. So every single one of you, big shout out.
No, definitely. I think it's sometimes we're buried in our own desks and we don't see that. So thanks for taking that time to pull that and giving me that few moments there.
You're welcome.
It's my thing.
So now let's dive back into what we're here for, though, because I am absolutely fascinated. Part of the most interesting part of these cases for me is always understanding the why and those checkpoints along the way that, like you say, aren't a finger-pointing exercise. They're a, hey, heads up, this is a hurdle we can look out for in the future.
And I think the marker here in terms of dates to think about is that the shooting occurs on November 30th of 2021. Mm-hmm. So just do the marker here. Thanksgiving in the States is on a Thursday, always on a Thursday. The
right.
Friday is a day of commerce. It is called Black Friday. And, you know,
that's
people are off
here
work.
As well. Thanks.
Yes. Yep. Oh, yeah. People are off work. People are off school. And there's a lot of shopping and a lot of sales that happen on Black Friday. So Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, there are some concerns raised that school a shooting occurs on Tuesday afternoon. So that is the time period when it occurs, November 30th, 2021. This report looks at is all of the time before that. And then critically in November of that year of 2021, what happened? So if I say November, I'm talking about November of that year. So I'm going to just kind of plug in here and give you some of what I think are the highlights of this, starting with the shooter entered the school in fourth grade. And the goal of this report was to see, were there red flags raised that could have been part of a threat assessment? So they tried to look at standardized test scores, and they have behavioral and social assessments that have been done by different people. They have programs in the school to try to assess the student's risk. So we'll talk about that. We even have a journal that the student was entering documents into. So this is very interesting. That's all. That's what I'm going to say. So they did a really deep dive, a very thorough examination of what was available. And they really focused this effort on whether there was relevant information that a threat assessment team could have looked at to do a threat assessment in those final days in November that might have prevented this shooting or even prior to that. They start with the elementary and middle school records, and they find that he was not the best student. But they say right at the outset, being not a good student, you have below average grades, and sometimes he was even failing a class, would not have triggered a threat assessment. Makes sense, right? So it's not a straight chronological report, just to be clear what you're going to hear. So they go to his grades in middle school and they say, okay, his middle school grades weren't great. There were some issues. He didn't particularly do well in math. I would say that I never did well in math. That doesn't make me a math shooter. He had a consistent counselor through this time period, and the counselor was asked occasionally to meet with this shooter because they felt that it not only was his classroom performance challenging and that his grades were challenging. And this is a kind of a one of the things that I thought was important. It said, in isolation, the fact that the shooter simply was not a high-achieving academic performer would not have raised any red flags. Being a poor student on its own is not a sign of a student in crisis. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to straight-up grades, they note at the very beginning of their report that he has a noticeable decline in his academic performance in November of 2021. The report says there is clear signs in several classes that the shooter had simply given up on doing his assignments altogether.
Wow.
Given up.
Yeah.
So just think of that in terms of where his grades are. So he comes to the school system in fourth grade. And the school where he was before fourth grade indicates that he really had issues paying attention. He had trouble with math, but he didn't really have any huge behavioral problems. And really at the outset of both fourth and fifth grade, he kind of achieves what they call a partial mastery, which they graded at 1 to 4. And he gets a 2, right, which is partial mastery of the academic things that he needs to do. So he's not a stellar student. He's getting C's and some D's from the outset as a young child. So he's kind of on this path from the beginning where he's definitely having some challenges. And in the early years, they say in the elementary school that he has some concentration problems, that he is often needs to be separated from his friends. He is easily distracted, which could be a description of every kid in school.
Right. Yeah. Right?
But they're looking back and they're saying, okay, well, these are the things that were actually documented. And I think that's something that's important for a threat assessment to consider is that, you know, all kids might have to be disciplined or threatened to be separated from their friends and things like that. When a school starts documenting it, right, when a teacher documents it, it means more to them. It's a behavior that they're seeing that's repetitive. So something that we get out of threat assessment that he is, by the end of fifth grade, still struggling with math, and the parents are told that he is going to be enrolled in a math lab course that will help him in middle school and in his sixth grade classes. He has had these kinds of little behavioral problems, but they begin to see email correspondence between the mother of the shooter and the teacher in both elementary school, like fourth and fifth grade. And the mother expresses back to the school in fourth and fifth grade that she believes that the shooter is perhaps being bullied, and that she wants the teachers to help resolve that problem. So that's a lot of years earlier.
As a fourth grader. Yeah. Remind us of what year he's in when the shooting occurs.
15 years old. He's at the end of his second year of
high school.
Secondary high school, right?
Yeah. Okay. Got you.
So at the end of his elementary school, fourth, fifth, you go fourth to through 12th, right? Last grade is 12th. So at the end of fourth and fifth, his mom is already having exchanges with school officials saying, hey, I think he's being bullied a little bit. And they're noting that he has concentration problems, he's distracted, but not any creating any concerning behaviors. And there's notations in the records that show that there's a concern with the mom. The reviewers tried to talk to those teachers who taught him back then. And the teacher said, yeah, we can't talk to you because there's lawsuits going on. So a lot of times they kind of stumbled into this situation when they were doing the evaluation. They might not be able to get more detail. So this is the detail they could get. So he goes on to middle school, which is sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. And he begins to receive failing grades in some of his core classes, language arts, Spanish, math, not surprisingly. And he gets warning letters about these failing grades at various times. And he is able to bring up some of his grades, but not all of them. And in the beginning, especially in math in sixth grade, even though he's enrolled in this math class, math lab, they call it, he's still having so much of a struggle that they bring in another teacher to just give him some intervention. And his performance in the other classes does continue to slip through that second semester. Like, you know, when kids transfer to middle school, they have adjustment problems, but they kind of get past it as they get better at accommodating middle school environment where you're moving to different classrooms and things like that. But here, because things are so troubling in sixth grade, he's getting academic letters of concern mailed to his house, showing that he's in danger of failing one or more classes. Middle school, sixth grade, except for Spanish. He manages to raise his grades up near the end of the school year, and he gets passed to the next grade, which is seventh grade. Seventh grade, he is getting C's and D's in English and D's in math. And again, more academic intervention letters that go to the parents to say, your child is struggling. We're going to put your child in an academic intervention advisory course in the beginning of the next year, eighth grade. So middle school is all a struggle, right? Mm-hmm. He's so far, it's a straight challenge. But they put him in this intervention effort in eighth grade. And in eighth grade, his grades go up. People are paying attention to him. He's getting help. He gets on the academic honor roll for the first time in his life.
Okay.
He gets an A minus in math, a B plus in language arts, a B in Spanish, an A in history, a B in science, B plus in science, a B in computer programming. And then what happens in the end of that academic year, March of 2020? COVID. So they say, well, let's see how he was doing. They go back and they look at his standardized test and what the teachers say about him during this time period. His standardized tests show, consistent with the teacher's observations in the classroom, below grade level expectations on all the standardized tests. Teachers mark these notes like, he does not use his time wisely, which I've been guilty of, and certainly he lacks the attention. He does not participate. He needs to improve his self-control. So one of the shooter's seventh grade teachers comments that the shooter is showing good effort. One of them observes he is showing initiative and interest. So there's an effort that's being made in seventh grade, right? Remember, he's got a lot of classes that he's failing in seventh grade. One of the teachers they talked to from middle school says he was quiet. He was an average student. He was kind of shy. And then a third teacher recalls that it was very challenging to keep the shooter on task and to get him collaborating with other students. And she had the impression that he had been experiencing bullying and exclusion, right? A lot of the teachers in the middle school say he was under the radar. They use that phrase. He was under the radar. They remember the shooter is a student who struggled academically and was kind of indifferent about his grades. He had some friends over the years, but he didn't interact with a lot of students. None of the teachers from the middle school years, for the most part, said he had any disciplinary problems. Some said he was sweet and he was never disrespectful. So they didn't view him as a discipline problem. They viewed him as an academic problem.
I think that's a really important point. And also, I might not be the only person out there that would have assumed that someone on that pathway to violence had a history of bad discipline in classrooms as well. So that's quite interesting.
He definitely shows from these records that the teachers are managing a lot of people and everything is going okay. And he's kind of under the radar and they're dealing with the problem children in their classrooms so often, especially middle school hormones. And he's not causing any disturbances. He's just not really buddying up with people from an academic standpoint. He's not being very successful. So that's its own kind of interesting challenge.
From DNA testing to the Dixie Mafia, Crime Capsule brings you new stories of true crime in American history. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. Join us for exclusive interviews with authors from Arcadia Publishing, writing the hottest books on the most chilling stories of our country's past. You can find us wherever you get your favorite podcasts or on evergreenpodcasts.com. Crime Capsule, history so interesting, it's criminal.
Have you ever felt that pang of disappointment when you couldn't add a ticket to your collection because it was digital? Or maybe you just lost it? Well, StubForge.com is here to change that. Imagine this: tickets that not only look but feel like the real deal. Because each ticket from StubForge is printed on the same quality stock that Ticketmaster uses and printed with genuine ticket printers. It's like holding a piece of the concert, the game, or the show right in your hands. But StubForge isn't just about replacing tickets. With the easy-to-use interactive designer, you can create custom tickets for anything, from concerts to sports games, pregnancy announcements, or parties. Why not make your invitations stand out with tickets that are as unique as your event? And if you're trying to complete a back catalogue of missing tickets, StubForge offers bulk discounts to make it both easy and affordable. With StubForge, you can once more give your loved ones physical tickets and see their eyes light up instantly at the best gift you can give. So whether you're looking to reignite your ticket collection, craft the perfect gift, or send the coolest invites, head over to StubForge.com. Start creating today and see how StubForge makes every ticket a story worth saving. Visit StubForge.com and start making tickets today.
Some of these are just straight up law enforcement records because the evaluators weren't able to get information directly from some of these people. But when law enforcement does speak to the dean of students after the shooting, he's asked about the entry from sixth grade recorded in the shooter's disciplinary log. The entry is dated from January of 18, and it indicates that the dean of students spoke to the shooter, quote, in regard to behavior in class by scaring a student by charging at him when the student accidentally ripped his work. So this is the first time we see aggressive behavior documented.
Yeah.
Right? The dean and the shooter, this is what the record says, discussed making better choices and getting an adult to assist in solving problems. The dean tells law enforcement he did not recall the shooter until he saw the disciplinary entry, and so he was unable to provide any other information. So it was, in the dean of students' mind, a relatively unremarkable event. Something happened in a classroom. Kid got sent to the dean of students, said, make better choices, made a note in the record, sent him away, forgot all about him, which you can see happening in every school every day. So the reviewers also went back and looked at emails, and they said, okay, let's look at the emails that we had about this behavior and whether or not there was any communication to the parents about it. They didn't see any significant behavioral or disciplinary issues in emails. The parents did get primarily focused on the shooter's kind of middle schoolish sort of behavior. Hey, can you tell him to behave a little bit better? He needs to try a little bit harder. He needs to get those grades up. Like, he got a lunchroom detention once, you know, for his behavior. So he's doing things, but they're not rising to some level very often where it's a concern. But one email from the school to the home that did stand out from the rest is he had a geography teacher in middle school. And the teacher reported that when he was collecting a quiz, he came by to collect the quiz from the student, from the shooter. And the shooter said that he had deliberately done poorly on the exam in an effort to get his parents' attention. And so I'll just read you what the email said. I'm contacting you in regard to an incident that occurred in geography class today. I'm going to just use the word shooter. The shooter took his geography quiz today during class. We checked it together. As I was collecting it, I noticed that the shooter had received a 70%, and he had written this message. I did it on purpose. When I asked the shooter about the note, he said that he wanted you to notice his geography grade. He thought he would get your attention by receiving a low score on the quiz, even though he knew all the correct answers. The shooter will be able to fix and repair this quiz for an improved score of 80% next week, but I felt that you should be aware of the shooter's actions today.
Cry for help.
Such a cry for help, right?
Mm-hmm.
So here's a pause and a question. Should that have prompted a threat assessment at that point? I'm trying to get attention from my parents.
I certainly think it should have prompted some intervention from the school. What's your thoughts?
What it kind of begs the question for me is, at that time, we don't have a lot more information, but at that time, did somebody go back and look at his grades? And that's going to be a consistent theme here. You know, it's not just that him saying he needs attention from his parents and he's going to screw the grades for the attention. But are there other things that essentially is like what a threat assessment team does, right? That's what a counselor is trying to design to do. Maybe if they just saw a kid who didn't have big disciplinary problems, occasional here and there, you know, goofball actions, and had struggled with grades over and over again. Why now? Why this?
And also that lack of behavioral issues in the classroom as well.
Right. Exactly. In the analysis, they continue to look at scores and on these standardized tests, for instance. And in middle school, the shooter receives 5 different interventions during his 3 years at the middle school, 5 different academic interventions. And those are designed by the school district, which is a very good area, very nice, you know, resources for the schools. He's enrolled, as I mentioned, in the math lab. After the shooting, the math lab teacher tells law enforcement that she assigned the shooter to a seat close to her desk because he needed extra attention to stay on task. She remembers that he would make disruptive noises in the class, which led her to contact his parents and send him to lunch detention. He was disrupting the class. In the last 10 weeks of sixth grade, he was placed in a more intensive math intervention, as I mentioned before. They're trying to get her to pass the class. But the teachers are characterizing the shooter as, once he gets to the point where he might fail, then he is quiet and not disruptive. So like when he's pushed to behave, he does behave, right? And that's great. That's what you want. Then he's enrolled in these intervention classes in eighth grade and his grades improve. And so that's great. So what happens once he gets to high school, which is, of course, the criticality, right? The high school shuts down because of COVID. And there's been so much discussion about the challenges of COVID. Now, what did they do where you live for COVID?
We shut down. We went online, onto school online. I always think we should have written it down at the time, but we went into several long periods of lockdown to the point that we had 2 children in major exam years that missed out on most of their schooling, like 18 months of disrupted schooling from COVID.
I thought you were going to say you had 2 children. I was like, wait, what?
I had 2 COVID babies. I had two There's nothing kids. Else to do.
Right.
No.
So you had 2 kids who didn't even have their kind of big final exams to get into colleges, university.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And here in March of 2020, everything shut down. So 3 years before this shooting happens, the school shuts down in the spring of 2020, as we all dealt with, but they return to in-person schooling the next year, right? And they have these, you know, protocols for COVID safety, like we all did, hybrid models. Some people are learning outside, some inside. And the students are required in this district to revert to remote learning if they have COVID or if they're exposed to them, just like I think most school districts were.
Yeah.
So here's what we know right away. It appears from grades and everything that the shooter, who has attention issues, really struggled with both in-school COVID protocols and virtual learning, which was very common, right?
Yeah.
That is not a red flag, right? And this shooter is a 9th grader at the time. And his teachers say that lots of the kids in the class are very quiet. They seem isolated because of the protocols. So the shooter is that way. But that's exactly how every
typical.
Kid is.
Yeah.
Typical.
For their class.
Right. No red flags at all. The mom contacts the school at some point in 9th grade and says that our shooter is really having difficulty with online schooling. And the shooter's parents note that again when they meet with the school personnel the day of the shooting, which is, like, if you don't know, an incredible story. The shooter's grades reflect the struggle and his grades drop back down. What is about his demeanor in school? Many of the teachers who were interviewed and the information they could glean said he was quiet. He seemed isolated during classes. He did not participate in classes. He did not interact with any classmates. He did just enough work to pass the class. He was often late in handing in his assignments. Nothing positive on academics, but no disciplinary issues. So what are the behaviors that you're looking for? One of the things that I thought was so super relevant is that we always think they're a discipline problem. But when we looked at what are the concerning behaviors, I'm going to just pull it right off of the FBI's, it's on my website in case you need it. The concerning behaviors, it's in the resources section, but this is the FBI, our behavioral team, when they looked at our cases. What were the concerning behaviors that the majority of the shooters they looked at? Mental health issues, impersonal interactions, interpersonal interactions, right? Those are two. But then right below that, leakage, quality of thinking and communications, work performance, school performance. Underneath that, well below, you know, 10% below, threats, confrontations, anger, physical aggression. This child at the time fit right into that, right? He had quality of thinking, communication, work performance, school performance, which are well above things that involve threats, yes, confrontations, anger. He is very typical in that way of the behaviors of concern. And what the violence stems from, an inability, right, in part, to be able to manage the communications and the work performance. Imagine trying to fail a test so that you can get your parents to pay attention to you.
And also, do you know the thing that's ringing in my ears at the moment is that the teachers thought of this person as under the radar.
Right. Yeah, the teachers who said, he's kind of under the radar.
Totally.
And a child who's under the radar, he's not causing any disciplinary problems. But on the other hand, he doesn't have any friends. His schoolwork is really failing. He's struggling to get a parent to pay attention to him. And this is, mind you, this is just the school records. There's a whole other set of records that have to do with the child and the communication that the child had, you know, with the parents separately, right? This is just the school records and what they were able to glean from the school records. And the question was, should there have been a threat assessment done on the student? How culpable is the school for a threat assessment, you know, if wishes were pennies, right? So no demeanor issues at school, but academic performance continually, you know, is a challenge. We know now, looking back, he has struggled academically, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade. He's in ninth grade. He's still struggling academically. So he's going to be more frustrated. He's going to feel like school is such a challenge and he just wants to get out of school.
It cannot be his happy place.
Absolutely. And that is being able to step back and look and say, this has been a struggle for him the whole time. So his teachers are entering comments as he goes on that are like, he fails to follow directions. And here's a statement that's in here. It appears as if the shooter's standardized test scores in combination with his poor classroom performance in algebra should have led the school to provide him with this certain new level of support, right? And did they do that? Did they miss that? We don't see any documentation, they say, that there was this intervention. So remember the intervention that he got earlier. Now we're in like COVID, things are just a mess. And so everybody's just trying to do the best they can. And even though his record kind of indicates that he would be better at getting this intervention for algebra, he doesn't get it. But the upheaval of COVID takes everybody with it, right? And so the shooter's declining academic performance over this first year, and this is his, like, the second semester of his ninth grade year. The shooting occurs at the end of the first semester of his 10th grade year. So we're in the year where the shooting occurs.
Right.
The shooter's declining academic performance over the course of his first year at the school causes several teachers to bring him to the attention of the student support staff. And his computer science teacher responds to a school-wide offer to provide extra support for struggling students. I think this is interesting. There's a person in the school system that has a program called Wake Up Wednesday. And this is a student group that she leads on Wednesday mornings before school. So any student that needs extra help, this is what I'm saying is this is a school that has lots of resources.
Yeah.
They make an effort, right? So there's a teacher who comes in on Wednesdays and she sends a note out, you know, in January and says, anybody who wants to come to Wake Up Wednesday, send them my way. Everybody is welcome. And right away, the computer science teacher identifies 8 students, including the shooter, and says, hey, how about these guys? So what happens is, this is in January of 21. They have no record that the shooter ever goes to Wake Up Wednesday, even though they've mentioned it. And so there is an English teacher who recommends that the student go also. And the English teacher, the very next day, sends a note and says, I sent an email last night and I'm going to reach out again in the class today, but can you please skip the shooter right now? It may push them over the edge. Long story short, the shooter thinks everything is bad. I'm holding him to speak with him directly during lunch today. She's withdrawing and saying, okay, look, maybe I can deal with him directly, but I don't want to push him over the edge by telling him he's a problem and he needs to go to this Wednesday thing. And this is the end of the semester. So we're talking about grades. And what's interesting is that the one who runs the Wednesday event answers back and says, I can do it either way, but to take an E, which is a failing grade, when you have the chance to pass just by doing one assignment, seems ridiculous. You have bent over backwards. I hope they just decide to pass him. So the teachers and the counselors feel like they're doing everything they can to help. It's COVID, but they can't seem to get through to him, I think is what it says. So May comes. It's kind of near the end of the school year. Two of the teachers contact the school counselor. They're concerned about the student's classroom performance. And mind you, this evaluation is done to say, did the school know enough that they should have done threat assessments? The ninth grade language arts teacher contacts the counselor and says, can you please meet with the shooter? When you get a chance, he seems down. Just check and see how he's doing. He's failing in my class and he tries to sleep all the time. I think what you see in these communications, they're very good in this report about giving us the actual, photograph of the emails, communications back and forth. You can see how challenging it is for a school. English teacher says, hey, I want you to meet with him. He's sleeping in class all the time and he's failing my class. And the counselor says, I'm doing this all day, but I'll try to catch him before the end of the day. And that is later in the afternoon. And then, hey, the biology teacher says the shooter is refusing to take a test. And this is at the same time, biology teacher, the same day, emails and says to the counselor in this email, I just have to tell you, he refused to retake the test. He got a 47% on it. We have spent an hour preparing for it. He told me he would rather fail biology and take it again next year. I told him that we were going to have to set up a meeting with his counselor and parents because I think he is better than that. And then not even 3 minutes later, you call asking for him. And the reason the counselor called asking for him was because another teacher said, he's sleeping in my class all the time and he's failing. Now, have we risen to a level of concern?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. You've got a few pieces of the puzzle coming together.
Mm-hmm. But in an interview with law enforcement, the biology teacher says that the counselor had called to send the shooter to the office, and that wasn't uncommon. She didn't want to embarrass the shooter by describing what was going on, his refusal to retake the test. She sent an email to the counselor because she didn't want to call him out in front of everybody at school. And then the counselor, when interviewed by law enforcement, said, yeah, I don't really remember this. The counselor was asked directly by law enforcement, during his freshman year, did you have any interaction with him? And the counselor said, not really. Not that I remember. So child failing classes left and right, right? Even though there were inquiries, somehow, wasn't quite getting there. So the school
fell under the radar.
Right? A very scary kind of concept of when somebody falls under the radar, are they dropping out of school and they just become a challenge in society? Are they planning the next shooting? How would you know? Because you don't have a touch on them. Are they having problems at home? Are they abused at home? Are they drinking all day? You know, all those kinds of things, right? So the reviewers did look at email correspondences with several of the ninth grade teachers sending messages to the parents, alerting them to all these missing assignments and things like that. They sent an email to the parents in May, alerting them that he might have to attend summer school. He was failing three of his classes at the time, and the parents generally responded. So everybody has a little piece of him and everybody says he's sleeping in my class. He's failing my class. He's not doing his assignments, but they're saying them all separately. Right? That is the point of a threat assessment. Not that you can do a threat assessment on every child, but that's the point of evaluating a student as a whole. Right. And now there are systems much more than there used to be in place to evaluate the student as a whole, because we know that in elementary school, a teacher evaluates the student as a whole. He's not a good math student, but he does great in science. So math, he just needs some help in. He's struggling with language arts, or he has a language problem like stuttering, but we can get him assistance for that because he's really smart, because I see what he does in his science and math classes. And
yeah,
in middle school and high school, we're not designed to look at a person altogether. And so somebody has to do that, you know, tie together all these pieces. And that's what a threat assessment does. But when does it rise to a threat assessment level? And when we do risk threat assessment, there's always, are they at low risk, medium risk, high risk? And sometimes when you determine somebody's at low risk, they're not even on the radar. We don't do any extra work for them. So let me suggest to you something that is very now, not when we were in school, that came up in this review, which kind of was like, for me, it was like, oh yeah, that's what happened. When my kids were in school, when I was in school, assignments were pretty much like written out, handwritten, whatever, and turned in. But now they turn their assignments in electronically.
Oh yeah. It's all on apps.
It's all on apps. That,
yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Right. So this school district uses a Google Drive for assignments. And so here is a challenge, right? The Google Drive is the students. It's not the whole thing that the school looks at. You have the documents or the test or whatever. And then when you're ready, you turn them in. And what would the teacher have access to in the system? You don't necessarily know the answer to that question, but what would you think?
I would think that they would have access to what homework has been turned in.
Mm-hmm. So what happens is when they go back and they look at what kinds of things are in his Google Drive, here are some of the things that shows that the shooter was struggling with his social and emotional health. The shooter filled out a wellness inventory done annually, and they say, we're going to help to get this information about this student and see how he feels emotionally, how he thinks he's doing. So it was saved on his Google Drive in September of 20. The survey had 90 true and false questions and 5 essay questions. And he answered false to these statements. I am happy most of the time. I have a number of people in my life who I care for and care for me. All of these he answered false. I can share with others my feelings and concerns. I feel good about who I am. I can go to sleep easily. I like my body. I can develop friendships when I move to a new place. I can go to a party and have a good time. I like people. False.
Wow.
I am not overly worried about the future. False. I can accurately assess my strengths and weaknesses. I care about what happens to my fellow man and woman. False.
Oh.
I trust my ability to make good decisions.
False. Oh.
A year before the shooting, he fills out a wellness survey.
I mean, that's got to be a massive red flag. Who's got eyes on that?
He actually filled it out as an assignment for his health class.
And did it get handed in?
It was due September 14th. It's unclear if he submitted it.
Or if it stayed on his Google Drive. Mm-hmm. I mean, because that is just literally... Oh.
Right.
I mean, that
he's clearly running it,
screaming out for help.
Yeah. And they don't want to reach out any further than the evidence shows. So they say, hey, you know, we don't have any evidence that he turned it in or didn't turn it in. And health teacher would not talk to them.
Right? Yeah. But that certainly speaks to the state of his mind and where he's at.
And in October of that year, 3 weeks after the wellness survey is done, he saves 2 documents in his Google Drive that they categorize as suggests he's in a troubled emotional state. At 7:50 in the morning, he saves an untitled document on his school computer drive that contains these statements. It's got 1, 2, 3. One is, I have no emotions. 2 is, fear run, IDK. 3 is, don't get angry and keep the anger in.
Wow. They are 3 of the most chilling statements I think I've heard out of your mouth in a long time.
I have no emotion. An hour later, he types this. And this is a year before the shooting. He types this an hour later. I really have no stress at all. I am a stress-free person. I have never had stress in my life, as far as I know. I really don't think puberty is a stress thing, as it does not affect me in any way. I do get about 3 or 4 hours of sleep at night, and that is perfect for me because I have sleep deprivation, and I get full rest with those hours. So it's less than 8 hours of sleep, but it's not putting any stress on me. So really, I think my stress level should be zero, but it is whatever. I don't really care. I never care about anything. And that it helps me not really have stress, I guess. Doesn't care about anything. He's like clearly struggling. The class shows that he submitted a graded assignment entitled Emotion Poster and another graded assignment entitled Stress Level, both with dates that match these kinds of things. The two documents described appear immediately to fit those titles and timeframes, but they can't say for sure that those were the assignments.
So they're saying that they found them on the Google Drive, but they can't confirm that they were ever turned in to a teacher for anybody at the school to have had eyes on them, which is crucial, I guess, in terms of whether or not they would have had the pieces to put into place for a threat assessment.
But wait, there's more. Towards the end of the semester, he definitely turns in, and the health teacher sees a document that she remembers one of his responses on a self-assessment. And she later provides the assignment to law enforcement after the shooting. In an interview with law enforcement, she says that in December of 2020, 11 months before the shooting, she asked her students to rate their mental, physical, social, emotional health and well-being. She remembered that he responded to one of the questions by stating that he wished his parents were home more, and she agreed to search for the assignment after the interview. We reviewed a document that appears to be the assignment she described, which is entitled, How Are You Doing? When asked to rate his social-emotional health, including family, friends, interactions, depression, and feelings, the shooter gave himself the lowest rating, a rating of 1, which corresponded to the phrase, I am really struggling and I need help.
Wow.
The shooter added, I only talk to my parents and only see them a couple of times a day.
Screaming for help.
And he has turned that assignment in.
The thing that you read out just prior to that was telling himself to keep those emotions in. But yet, he can't.
He knows they're there. They're bubbling up, right? He mm-hmm. knows they're there. So during the school year, he also turns in a history assignment related to the American Dust Bowl crisis, which was a horrible time around the time of the Depression. Here's what he turned in. He submitted it to his history teacher, including two slides that were journal entries written by the shooter in the voice of a farmer from northern Oklahoma. One of the journal entries included a graphic description of cannibalism.
Oh, my God.
Cannibalism. Right. That's like, ew, right? Most of the documents saved in the Google Drive, they said, would not have been available to the school personnel unless they were doing a threat assessment and they asked for them. So here we have a kid who is going downhill. He's writing things in his own journal. And then when we get to this fall semester of 10th grade, which is really probably a great stopping point, you know, what did his grades look like? What was his demeanor? Because now we're into the school year where the shooting happens, and the shooting happens at the end of that semester. So we want to get a little bit more into next time. And what's his demeanor? What's his academic performance? How is he doing in particular classes and what the teachers saw? And then I really want a chance to share a little bit about what was in his journal, because some of the teachers say he was writing in his journal all the time instead of doing homework.
Wow.
So
much still to unpack. Yeah, let's definitely pause now and come back to it in the next episode. And listen, if you can't wait, you can go to patreon.com/stopthekilling and go straight on to part 2. It'll be ready in there for you to binge. And same with the Apple subscribers. You can get early access to this next episode. But for us, we're going to push pause now and go back and record the next episode.
Something is creeping in. Don't follow it down.
Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorised financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy, and you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
It was all fictitious.
You stole from my son, who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that were all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt Clooghless.
I want to take a moment to tell you about my podcast, Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage. In 1984, a woman named Phyllis Cottle was abducted in broad daylight, tortured, and left to die in a burning car in Akron, Ohio. At the time, I was a rookie reporter covering this horrific story. Since then, I've reported every kind of crime imaginable. I've been able to leave most of them at work, but not this one. The one that buried itself under my skin and stayed put. Phyllis Cottle was a badass woman, and I want to tell you her story. A production of Evergreen Podcasts and signature title of the Killer Podcast Network, you can find Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage wherever you get your podcasts. Discover more great true crime and paranormal programming at killerpodcast.com.